Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Ballot to Talk About. This week, we'll be looking back at results from the general election held in Croatia, and we'll also be spending time looking ahead to the big upcoming general election in South Africa. And we'll be asking the big question: is the ANC about to lose its overall majority for the first time since the end of apartheid? It's Saturday, the 20th of April, 2024.
Pledge to be a president who seeks not to divide but unify.
Not now. I am a fighter and not a quitter.
It's time for a change in this country, my friends. A real change.
Let's keep moving.
Slava Ukraini!
And joining me, as always, is my co-host Churn. Churn, how is everything going?
Well, apart from the fact that it's just as we were discussing before we press record, it is 24 hours after the Torture Poets Department was released, and we tried listening to, well, not all, but at least some. We got to at least some of it. So I think that's a big, well, apart from the big events that are taking that this week, I just thought that that's the other big event that's taking place this week, isn't it?
I mean, that is the main news of the last 24 hours, even though we have some politics to unpack somewhere down the line. But yeah, Taylor Swift's absolutely mammoth album dropped yesterday, and I'm sure that's been taking up quite a bit of our time.
Yeah, so really, who's listening to us this week, when I suspect everyone this weekend will be listening to and streaming what is already the most listened to album in Spotify's history? So we can just say whatever we want, I think. Sam, before we dive into this week's politics, today is, we're recording this completely by coincidence on the 20th of April, which is 420, the 420 movement, which is the legalized cannabis political movement. And I thought, just as a fun fact to kick us off, because it's the 20th of April, that there is a legalized cannabis party in Australia. And I can tell you that it has two seats in the Western Australian upper house, two seats in the Victorian upper house, and one seat in the New South Wales upper house. No seats currently in Queensland, because Queensland is, but I just thought that was a fun fact on this 420 day.
Yeah, very interesting. Very interesting. Well, Churn, this week we'll neither be discussing legalising cannabis movement nor Taylor Swift, but we will be unpacking two elections, one that has taken place and one that will be taking place. So in the second half of this week's episode, we'll be previewing the big general election upcoming in South Africa, one of Africa's largest democratic exercises. But first, Churn, we had, in the middle of this week just gone, the general election take place in Croatia, where Andrej Plenković's HDZ party was looking to continue its dominance of Croatian politics since the 1990 restoration of multi-party democracy. There's only been 7 years out of that 34 that it hasn't been in power. And Churn, it looks like Andrej Plenković will be getting a third term as prime minister, albeit not quite with a government looking exactly the same as it did before.
I think that's a very good place to start. You're absolutely right that that the HDZ, I didn't realize the extent to which they have dominated Croatian politics, as you said, all but 7 years. In fact, Andrej Plenković himself is Croatia's longest serving post-independence prime minister, even before these elections took place. In 2022, he became Croatia's longest serving prime minister since 1990. I should say that despite the long period of HDZ dominance, he is only one of two prime ministers to win two terms, let alone a third term. He's the only prime minister to have won three terms. So there has been a lot of changes in who has been Croatian prime minister, but even though the party has been in power for all but 7 years, as you said. But you're absolutely right. The HDZ-led coalition won this election. We should say that there were 150 seats that were up for grabs in the Croatian parliament, which means you need 76 seats for a majority, 151, I should say. The HDZ-led coalition got 61 seats, just down one, down six, with 34.4% of the vote. the Rivers of Justice Coalition, which is basically led by the SDP, the Social Democrats, got 42 seats. That's up 2 with 25.4% of the vote. Interestingly, the one of the big players within this coalition is the president, Zoran Milanovic, which we may be talking about later on. In third place was the DP-led coalition, in other words, the Homeland Movement, who got 14 seats up 2 with 9.6% of the vote. We Can, which is kind of a left-wing green political platform, got 10 seats up 5 with 9% of the vote. Most and Sovereigntists, which is kind of a coalition between a liberal and an ultra-conservative party, got 11 seats with 8% of the vote. And we have some two other parties which together won 5 seats with 5.6% of the vote. Sam, I think this election is very much one in which, frankly, even among you in Europe, it didn't make much of a wave beyond outside of its borders. It kind of slipped underneath the radar. But you and I have had a few days to digest this result and read a bit about Croatian politics. What is your reaction when you see this result here?
I mean, I think my overall reaction is not huge surprise because, as we said, the Croatian Democratic Union, the HDZ, has dominated Croatian politics for much of the post-independence period in Croatia. So it's not hugely surprising that they've topped the polls again because they've bedded themselves in quite well into Croatian politics. And by all accounts, Andrej Plenković as a prime minister has been reasonably successful. I'm sure we'll talk about, when we talk about why the HDZ has been so dominant, that Andrej Plenković personally has transformed that party into a more centrist, moderate party, which has grown its appeal. But what is interesting, Chen, when you're talking about the waves that this election has sent across Europe, is that this was another election between the HDZ and the SDP, where there was a contest going on between the more pro-EU, pro-Western wing, which is represented by Andrej Plenković and his party, and the more pro-Russian, pro-Eastern wing, which is represented by the SDP. So a bit like the Slovakian election, which was quite a seismic election with Robert Fico's return to the premiership, this was a contest to decide where Croatia sits in the current geopolitical debate, particularly around Russia-Ukraine. So from that sort of reaction, it does seem, from an international perspective, that this was an election that seems to be in favour of the more Western position. Obviously, Croatia is a very recent member of the European Union. Within the last just over a decade ago, Croatia joined the EU, and very recently as last year, joined the Eurozone and Schengen. So this was, could be seen as quite a precarious moment for Croatia's position as a more EU-centric country. And it seems in this election that they have endorsed that position of Andrej Plenković, albeit with some caveats because he will now have to find some partners for government. But I think that's my overall reaction to these results.
Just to pick you up something there, how much do you think the issue of Ukraine and sending military aid to Ukraine, because there was, like you said, an ideological divide between the HDZ and the SDP, was one of the big campaign issues? Because that wasn't my reaction to reading about it.
I think it wasn't necessarily the like central issue in this campaign, but both Milanovic, the president, who was the SDP's candidate for prime minister, and Andrej Plenković himself have been fiercely divided on this issue. There's absolutely no secret about that. And I think whilst it wasn't sort of a headline position, because a lot of that was to do with corruption, more economic issues, social issues, I think it was something that underscored the whole campaign, because it was no secret about where these two parties sat on one of the biggest issues of the day, particularly given that the SDP has been very critical of the EU for its Ukraine funding. It's wanting a more pro-Russian stance for Croatia in general. And as the president of Croatia, Milanovic has made no secret of that. So I don't think it's a unknown issue in this election, even if it wasn't the primary issue.
I think it's a fair assessment. I think you're right. People are aware of the divide between the candidates. They know that one is more pro-EU facing, one is more Eastern facing, and will align with the... I wouldn't necessarily argue that the SDP wants to leave the European Union, but definitely a more like on the Robert Fico kind of like less European integration wing of and that whole idea of politics than, let's say, the Western European more tilted HDZ. My read of this election is that I think it's reasonable to argue that both for the HDZ and the SDP, they both won and lost at the same time. HDZ, I think with these numbers, with 61 seats and being nearly 20 seats ahead of the SDP, it's quite impossible to form a government without the HDZ. So Andrei Plenković will remain prime minister. But at the same time, it seems difficult to get to 76 seats for his party. And conversely, I think the SDP, we've talked a lot about elections in which, you know, Croatia is not immune to the cost of living crisis, is not immune to this government has been in power since 2016. We'll later be talking about some of the reasons why the HDZ lost seats. And the SDP have failed to capitalize on that, in my opinion, is that they you know, only gaining two seats to 25% of the vote after we've seen so many other governments around Europe toss out their governments and a seven-year-old government. I think this is a quite a poor performance from the SDP's perspective. And so I think there's something for them to think about as well, don't you think?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think there's questions to be asked across the board. And Chen, I want to first talk about this, what this eventual government will look like, because I think that's one of the biggest questions after these results, because Andrei Plenković is now having to search for the numbers to either get to a majority or get close to a majority where he has confidence that he'll be able to pass, well, the confidence issues, the budget, any votes of confidence in him as prime minister, because it wouldn't be the first time that a vote of no confidence has been put on the floor against him as prime minister of Croatia. So he does need to be certain that he has close to the numbers. And from what I can see, it seems that Andrei Plenković has quite a stark ideological choice to make, because he could either turn towards the homeland movement, the more nationalist, further right wing of Croatian politics, because at the end of the day, the Croatian Democratic Union, the HDZ, Andrei Plenković's party, is by its very nature, historically, a nationalist conservative party. So that's one option. And then the other option is he turns more towards the weekend green leftist party, who will get them close to the overall majority, or they could turn to the MOST party, the bridge, the sovereigntists, the people who they've worked with before in government. But again, it's taking a different ideological approach. So what do you think is the most likely thing for Andrei Plenković to do?
Well, here's where this is part of the problem, is it? And it kind of reminds me of that Bulgarian elections in many ways, well, elections in plural, where, if you recall, GERB is strong enough to become first, but weak enough that they can't form a lasting government. I think it's a very similar situation here. And I think whatever I do say, I think has to be caveated in the sense that, as you said, there are many options, and each option might not deliver a government that lasts the full 4 years of the term. So I think that's an important thing for me to say. I think what is likely to happen is that the most likely scenario in the way I see the numbers falling down is a HDZ Homeland Movement coalition government. They are ideologically, as you said, closer together. And together they will have 75 seats, which is one seat short of an overall majority, which is 76 seats. But I think there are minor parties and independents that 75 seats will be enough to govern, particularly in the short term. So I think that's the most logical path, is that there'll be a HDZ, Homeland Movement, minority government. Homeland Movement, I should say, at this stage, its leader has said that it's open to working with both HDZ and the SDP. It's not revealed publicly who it will back, I suspect an attempt to extract maximum leverage from the HDZ in particular. So it's worth noting that as well. Moss sovereignty is pretty interesting because Moss has had the history of working with the HDZ right at just before Andrei Plenković came into power. So this was in 2015. They joined the government then. The government collapsed a year later. And so they've had a rather unhappy experience working with the HDZ. It's interesting that they teamed up the ultra-nationalist sovereignties. So that's the first observation that I made. I'm interested if they go into government, how within that alliance will actually work as a first point. And secondly, they said that one of their key conditions to supporting either the HDZ or the SDP is that, quote, during the election campaign is that each of these parties must accept their program and their prime minister candidate, Nikolai Gromoja, who is one of the leading figures within MOS. And let's be frank, that's not going to happen. And the MOS leader himself, Bozo Petrov, has also said that the HDZ should be sent into opposition. So I just don't think that dynamics between MOS and the sovereignties and that past working relationship with the HDZ and the statements they made during the campaign will make for a viable coalition. So to me, I think, as I said, the most logical will be a HDZ homeland movement, minority government, where they rely on one of the independents or the minor part or the other parties to pass legislation through. And they have options in that case.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you that I think that's where the most logical numbers seem to lie. But as I said at the beginning, I hinted at it about Andrei Plenković's personal history, is that I think a lot of the reason in recent years that the HDZ has become so established in Croatian politics is because of the work Andrei Plenković has put in to move the party further to the centre, to be able to sort of hog the moderate ground whilst the SDP has been moving further to the left. And I just am wondering whether Andrei Plenković personally will be a bit worried about what it looks like if they then get into bed in a coalition with the Homeland Movement, who are much further to the right than HDZ is right now, even though maybe 10 years ago they would have been much closer ideological bedfellows than they are in this moment. Just something to think about.
Possibly, but then I think why they would do that as well is just that for any other alternative apart from the Homeland Movement, I just think that there's too many other equations. Even if they team up with Moss or one of the other parties, just too many equations, and that's the same reason why the SDP can't form a coalition of anybody but HDZ, because they had to team up with the alternate conservatives. They had to team up with the Homeland Movement. They have to get the Weekend political platform on board as well, who have said they don't want to work with the Homeland Movement. So I just think that they just are not having that strength in. They will probably be able to form a government in that will last a short term, purely because there are no other viable options. And you're right about that long-term viability, but it will be up to the SDP, I think, or one of the other liberal parties to try and capitalize that. And so far, the evidence suggests to me that certainly in Croatia, they have a lot of work to do, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think you're right about to question the longevity of it, because it's only last March that the Homeland Movement led a motion of no confidence attempt against Andrei Plenković. They triggered it. They worked with the SDP and other smaller minority parties to try and get it passed. And actually, it backfired because the HDZ ended up using that as leverage to show that there was opposition unity of the far left and far right. But so clearly, Homeland Movement and the HDZ have some turbulent history between each other. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens on the government side. But Chern,
let's put it this way, Sam. Somebody's going to have to eat humble pie to get a government forming,
I think so. But Chern, very quickly, why do you think the opposition weren't able to be big beneficiaries of a reduction in support for the HDZ, and also a little word on why we saw that reduction in support as well.
Let's tackle the first bit about why the HDZ has become so entrenched. They are they have a much better machinery and resources. Some would argue a patronage system as well in Croat politics that's enabled them to dominate Croatia's political scene as well. Under Andrej Plenković and under the HDZ, they have seen Croatia's ascension to the European Union, the introduction of the euro, and a tourism boom. I've certainly been to Croatia in the last 5 years, and they are, particularly during the summer period, it is becoming increasingly a tourism destination that has translated to economic growth, and it has translated to the growth of industries, and Croatia has done well out of that as well. So I think there is some lingering goodwill towards the HDZ there. What do you think, Seb? Is there any other reasons that you think why the HDZ, before we talk about why they haven't done, why they've lost support over the last 4 years, any reason why that they have done so well over the last 30 years of Croat politics?
No, I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think they just became the sort of catch-all party, particularly in the aftermath of the restoration of multi-party democracy, because the SDP, like a lot of left-leaning parties in this part of the world, in Eastern Europe, does have some legacy associations with pre-multi-party democracy in terms of when in Croatia's case, when Yugoslavia existed, and everything that came before that, the more Russian influence in the Cold War as well. So there is a complicated legacy with a lot of these parties in this part of the world. But Chen, I think there's another reason why the HDZ did particularly well this time, which is that the opposition had a big problem in this election, and that problem was Zoran Milanovic, because it became such a story about Milanovic's attempt to be the prime ministerial candidate for the Rivers of Justice coalition. It was dragged through the court. Controversially, he was getting involved in the election. He was told by the court that in order to be the prime ministerial candidate, he would have to resign the presidency. He refused to do so. Therefore, he was not formally listed on election papers as the prime ministerial candidate. And frankly, it became a bit of a mess on the left of Croatian politics and a big story in this election. And I think it allowed, there are faults of the HDZ party. There were quite numerous corruption allegations levied at them throughout this campaign. But I think what was happening on the other side is that it became such a complicated constitutional mire about one person that I think it was very difficult for the opposition to present this united front that they conceived of when they formed this coalition, because there was such a divide on who that prime ministerial candidate was and whether constitutionally that was even going to be possible.
I will say though, Zoran Milanovic, I think he's the president of Croatia. It was literally hours after he announced the election date that he announced he was going to run to be prime minister. But the one thing I will say is that I had a look at the opinion polls before and after that announcement was made by Zoran Milanovic. And what we did see then was that the HDZ support didn't change whatsoever. So in the opinion polls, they held their support amongst that, despite that announcement. And all what we did see was that there was a transfer in support from the weekend political movement, that Green Left Party, to the SDP itself. So it was a intra-opposition reallocation of votes rather than a reallocation of vote between the governing party and the opposition party. So I think there is something to be said that the impact actually turned out to be rather negligible in the end, is that maybe the shenanigans related to the constitutional court, whether he was like to be prime minister, maybe they like a president. He is personally popular, I will say, Zoran Milanovic. He's consistently ranked as one of Croatia's most popular politicians, largely because he is seen as that straight-talking candidate, as you have hinted at. He has criticized the people of Bosnia, illegal immigration, military aid to Ukraine. I think when the judgment came out, I think he even called some of the judges illiterate as well, as one of his criticisms. But the impact of that, I think it turned out that it just reallocated votes among the opposition parties and did not dent HDZ support whatsoever.
Yeah, I think you're right about it being fairly negligible in the end. I think I was just thinking more about it's very difficult for the electorate to look at what was going on in the SDP and their choice of prime ministerial candidate and thinking, if you were someone who maybe was slightly sceptical on the incumbent government, I don't think you'd have been enamoured to be brought over to the opposition side, because you'd be thinking, I don't even know if it's constitutionally possible for this person to become prime minister. And if it wasn't Milanovic, does it have that much appeal? Because certainly Peder Gibrin, the SDP leader, doesn't inspire the same level of passionate support than Zoran Milanovic. And actually it became such a problem for Andrei Plenković that those two people, Milanovic and Plenković, never debated in this campaign. They did not attend any of the formal election debates because Plenković refused to debate with someone who he deemed to not be a possible prime minister. So I think it then became more of a battle just to retain government rather than opposition insurgency, because there was always question marks about what that would even look like.
I think that's possible. But I think my sense as well is that, think of it from the SDP's point of view, Zoran Milanovic has proven over the last, he was the SDP's last prime minister. He won the parliamentary elections in 2011. Surprisingly lost the 2015 election, it should be said. So and he has proven, having won the presidential election in 2019, at the end of 2019, start of 2020, that he can win a national popular vote. So I
mean, he'll be able to test that in December as well, because we'll be having the next presidential election and Zoran Milanovic is eligible to run for that.
Exactly. So I can definitely see why the SDP would turn to that, because if given where the SDP's position in Croatian politics, he is the most successful centre-left SDP leader ever. So why not we tap into that? But it was, I definitely think that it was, certainly from HDZ, there definitely is an argument that this was unusual, shall we say, constitutional arrangement for a president, certainly a notionally independent president, to then run for partisan politics once again. So, but I don't think that's something we are interested in. That's something, a story that we are interested in. But I think to the average voter, they are just comparing, will Zoran Milanovic be a better prime minister, or will Andrei Plenković be a better prime minister? Not this constitutional setup and the relationship.
Yeah.
And what could be a very tense relationship, let's be honest, certainly in the lead up to December, between Andrei Plenković, who's likely to remain prime minister, and Zoran Milanovic, who will likely to remain president, isn't it?
Yeah, well, Zoran Milanovic's role in this election, I don't think is quite over, because the president does retain the ability to appoint the prime minister and indicate who will be the preferred prime minister to try to put together a government. So whilst it does appear that that person at the moment is Andrei Plenković, who knows what may be in store for Croatian politics as they start to put together the next government.
One question, Sam, we talked about why HDZ is so dominant, but I think it's also worth to quickly talk about why they have lost support in this election, because they have to address those questions in order, should an early election be called, to try and regain some of the support to just make themselves in a slightly better position. Maybe their 2020 election result, which is about where they lost to not much, about 66 seats, in to be able to form a more stable long-term government that could last the term. So what were some of the reasons that you found that have led to this fall in HDZ support?
I mean, primarily, I think a lot of it has to do with government integrity and corruption allegations, because over the last 8 years that Andrei Plenković has been prime minister, there have been 30 ministerial resignations over various corruption allegations that include, and this list is not exhaustive, but it includes plagiarism, illegal brokering, abuse of position, embezzlement, manslaughter charges, performance concerns, and estate agent issues. So a huge range of issues that have created this image of the HDZ being an inherently corrupt party, the government just allowing this activity to go on, and also the turnover in ministers being that high in a relatively small cabinet is quite something. And naturally will affect policy delivery. And that's one of the reasons why the Homeland Movement launched their No Confidence motion last year, because they were concerned about policy failures in health and infrastructure, but and the ministerial affairs. So this, I think, was becoming a bit of an issue for the HDZ, and is one of the main reasons, I think, why they saw a bit of a drip of support.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. 30 ministers changing, and only actually 2 ministers retaining their posts since 2016. The culture and media minister...
I think the UK Conservative Party would say, hold my beer, when we're talking about a mere 30 ministerial resignations, but yeah.
You just stole what my next sentence was going to be like. So thank you for that. Now I have to think of a different sentence. The culture and media minister, deputy prime minister, and the transport minister, actually 3, and the other deputy prime minister and minister for Croatian veterans have been there since 2016. I'd just like to point out one of the big corruption scandals, which is a judge, Ivan Turudic, was appointed the state attorney of Croatia. This was a controversial appointment, as reviewed through leaked WhatsApp messages. He has linked with people such as Josipa Rimac, who was a former member of the HDZ and who has been previously indicted for corruption as well. So that's one example of that murky link between the judiciary and certainly the HDZ. And in April, for example, other leaked messages were published, apparently testifying to some dubious actions and deal-making with the same woman, Josipa Rimac, a former mayor herself, and the deputy prime minister and the minister for maritime affairs, transport, infrastructure, Oleg Batovic, involving suspicions of lobbying, influence peddling, and nepotism. And that story has been stories that's been going on throughout Croatian politics. So Sam, I wonder, therefore, if voters kind of baked in that those corruption allegations, isn't it? Because it's happened over a long period of time, and B, they are still able to gain first place. So yes, there's a rolling drumbeat, which has led to protests in Zagreb, the capital of Croatia, in early 2024. But it nevertheless seems to me that I think there's a certain proportion of voters that have baked in that this is unfortunately the reality of Croat politics, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think a bit like we were talking last week when we talked about corruption on all sides in South Korea, I think it's also something that's becoming a bit of a feature of Croatian politics, because over the course of this campaign, the president, Zoran Milanovic, publicly outed a HDZ minister as being gay. There were various corruption allegations levelled at the SDP. And of course, Milanovic also has been accused of trying to move Croatia into Russian orbit. So I think, yes, it's become a particular problem for the HDZ government, but I think there was enough to talk about on the other side that I think it was why we saw it having a little effect on them bleeding some seats, but not a seismic effect of bringing down the government as we see in some other countries when this level of corruption is talked about.
Possibly. And I should say as well, as my final thoughts before we should say as well that, do you know how many seats in the 2016 election, which Andrej Plenković won, and which he served a full term, did his HDZ party won, Sam? The answer is 61 seats, exactly the same as 2024. So he has put together a government that has lasted a long distance, but I think the caveat and the thing that I know is interesting is that what happened last time around was that there were more liberal options in 2016 that unlike this time around. And interestingly, in 2016, there are 8 seats in the Croat parliament that go to minority parties. All 8 of them backed the HDZ in 2016. That could be something in which could more minorities backing whatever government HDZ form could give them an even better buffer within the Croat parliament. It still won't be easy negotiations, but they have done it before. And I suspect definitely in the short term, Andrej Plenković would do it again.
Well, time will tell. So welcome back to Ballot to Talk About. As we pitched at the beginning of this episode, we'll now be moving on to preview the upcoming South African general election, which will be taking place at the end of May, where Cyril Ramaphosa, who has been president since 2018, will be going for his second full term as president of South Africa for his ANC party, after winning the last general election in 2019. Unlike other presidential democracies, if the ANC, his African National Congress party, wins a majority of seats in the National Assembly, he will be elected as the president. The president is elected by the National Assembly. But, Chern, the big topic of this election in most observers' lips is about the fact that the ANC, who have been in power since the first post-apartheid election back in 1994, who has been incredibly dominant for the last 30 years, doesn't look set to lose office, but certainly looks set for the first time not to obtain an overall majority of seats, if current opinion polls are to be believed. And that is partially at the expense of a slight increase in support for the Democratic Alliance, the main opposition party, and its leader, John Steenhuisen, but is also a lot attributed to the return of the former president, Jacob Zuma, whose new party, the Umkhonto weSizwe party, looks set to have quite an impact on the ANC's performance going into this election in just over a month's time. So, Chern, where do you want to start?
It was just striking when you read that out, that there's a slight correlation, isn't it, between the correct election results that we talked about just before the break and the South African results that are likely, if opinion polls are to be, are likely to happen, where in both countries you have a party that's been in power essentially almost, well, in this, in South Africa's case, uninterrupted, or one that suddenly dominated both countries' politics since the early 1990s. So that's the first similarity. And at the same time, we see the incumbent party getting weaker, but the opposition party is suddenly not in a position to dislodge them. So I think there's an interesting parallel between both countries' politics there. Where do we start? Well, I think we have to start at the ANC. It is the party of Nelson Mandela. It is one of the four most people, when they think of political parties in Africa, I think the ANC comes top to mind. But I think as well, it's interesting to work out why the ANC has declined in political support, because I think that's an interesting and key story to tell about why the opposition parties are being to be able to smell an opportunity in these elections. And I should say that the support has not been falling only recently. In 2009, 2014, 2019, they have lost seats. They lost 15 seats each in the 2009 and 2014 elections. They lost now 20 seats in the 2019 elections. So this has been an ongoing trend in South African politics. Sam, why?
Well, that is the big question. I think there's a whole host of reasons, some more longer term, some shorter term, some pretty abstract, some very tangible in terms of economic scores. But yeah, I think there's a whole host of reasons. First, Chern, I think one of the prevailing reasons is that over the course of this 30-year period, the ANC's role has slightly shifted, because obviously it started in the 1994 election with Nelson Mandela becoming South Africa's first black president in the first full suffrage election, as being the party that is symbolically ending the era of apartheid and white minority rule in South Africa. And I think that sort of that legacy, whilst it of course continues, has shifted when the prevalence of that moment has slightly diminished, because there is now no longer a need for the ANC to have a supermajority to prevent South Africa from falling into white minority rule again, because that is just unlikely to happen in this election. That's certainly not what any of the parties are campaigning on. So then you start to shift to a political system which is more about outcomes, more about the more bread and butter social economic outcomes of the government. And to be honest, the ANC's record has not been particularly great when it comes to economic outcomes. The World Bank has South Africa with the highest Gini coefficient in the world, which is the coefficient that measures the level of income inequality in that country. South Africa's coefficient is 0.67, and that scores between 0 and 1, with 1 being absolute income inequality, where one person owns all of wealth and everyone else earns nothing. So to have 0.67 is very high. By contrast, the UK's is 0.35, if that sort of helps you understand this number. You also have huge income inequality within South Africa. So the Gauteng province, which houses Johannesburg, the main province, the most populous province, has double the GDP of the second highest province on that list, which is KwaZulu-Natal. And unemployment is at 32.1% in the last quarter of 2023, which is up from Q3 of 2023 and is projected to rise even further in Q1 of 2024 after two large mining corporations announced quite a raft of job losses. And that is disproportionately affecting younger voters, who some of which have never got onto the employment ladder because of that high unemployment rate. So that's just two examples of economic outputs which are pretty poor. And I think for any government of any stripe in any country around the world, those sort of figures will cause you problems when you go to the ballot box. And that's, I think, one of the issues. And then the other issue being corruption because of Jacob Zuma's legacy. Jacob Zuma has been facing quite an intense corruption investigation for his time as president, which involves quite a number of government ministers who are still in Cyril Ramaphosa's government. So that's a problem. And then you have the separate problem, which is Jacob Zuma completely refutes these allegations, refutes them so much that he's now running on a separate ticket in this election, which is taking chunks out of the ANC's support. So quite a lot there, Chern, but anything to add, anything to disagree with, agree with?
I want to talk about Jacob Zuma a little bit later, but let me just add a couple more problems the ANC has also faced. You've listed the main economic ones. Power cuts are a problem, despite the fact that South Africa has an abundance of, it's a huge abundance of solar energy. And it's an indictment that the country's power grid still relies lots on coal, despite its potential to rely on solar power. I think many South Africans don't, frankly, have their own generators because they, frankly, do not rely on Eskom, the main state utilities company, because it's so badly run. Load shedding, which is the term in which is basically the it's more valuable to nick the metal that are part of the electricity infrastructure and sell that on rather than allow that to remain in place, has meant that the power grid and the transmission system is in an absolutely dire state. Freight is, and in general, transport infrastructure at South Africa's ports is poor, which meant has moving goods in and out of the country is tough, adding to supply chain issues as well, not helping with the cost of living and inflation as well. And lastly, Sam, I can tell you that in the last 3 months of 2023, on average in the country, there were 130 rapes and 80 murders. So it's also, frankly, not been a safe place with high levels of violent crime as well. So I think all those factors mix into the fact that the reality is that you're getting a generation of young South Africans who, frankly, do not have that goodwill that older South Africans, particularly Black South Africans, have towards the ANC for giving them freedom and getting rid of that apartheid system. There are now these large pools of young Black South Africans who, yes, they have their older generations their parents might be grateful for getting them the freedoms and for seeing a general improvement of in their own economic position, seeing a bigger Black middle class, the slight reorientation of the economy, for example, a decent home, improving access to health and education. But their children are not feeling the current economic benefits, and therefore they are increasingly looking to other parties for other options as well.
I mean, Chern, all that said, the ANC are not projected to fall out of government, are they? It's no. Simply that they are looking likely to lose for the first time an overall majority. And when we talk about the ANC's dominance of South African politics, we're not talking about sneaking a majority each time. until 2019, this party had never fallen below 62% of the primary votes. That's the level we're talking about now. And for reference, in the last opinion poll published in South Africa, they were at 37%. So that's the sort of level of fall we're talking about here. So yes, they have all these problems, but still the ANC look likely to be leading the government following this election.
And why is that there's been such a big fall in party support, Sam? Well, I think a big reason for that can be attributed to an emergence of a player in which, frankly, I am surprised has re-emerged on the South African political scene, because he left it in disgrace, because it is the former president, Jacob Zuma, who is 82 years old. So I suspect he's taking a leaf out of Joe Biden's playbook there. But he resigned the presidency in disgrace in 2018, because he has faced 16 charges of corruption, largely over a multi-billion arms deal. He has had corruption and, in fact, rape allegations follow him throughout the last 20 years of his political career. Some of the corruption scandals include his close relationship with the Gupta family. That's one of the key scandals that dogged his presidency. And over his home in KwaZulu-Natal and his allegations that state funding was used for the construction of a very luxurious home, including a theater, a swimming pool, its own, I think, football field as well. So he is got a controversial legacy. How on earth is he still having an impact in this election? Is my question. Any theories, Sam?
I mean, I think there was some level of surprise across South African media and international media that the courts upheld Jacob Zuma's attempt to be a candidate in this election. And because of that, he will be the top candidate on the list for the Mkhonto Wesizwe party. I think it's worth saying at this point how this election works, because then you'll understand the list, is that there's 400 seats in the National Assembly. 200 of them are elected via national party lists, and the other 200 from the party and independent list in the 9 provinces of South Africa. And then all of them together come together to elect the president. But Jacob Zuma will be top of the national party list for Mkhonto Wesizwe, so the primary candidate. And in all likelihood, if the polls are to be believed, will absolutely be getting a seat in the National Assembly. So there was some surprise that, given the prison sentence he faced, given the charges against him, that the courts allowed his candidacy to continue. But nonetheless, he'll be the top of that list. But Chen, I think one of the main reasons he's returned is because he has a personal score to settle with Cyril Ramaphosa, because they've been long-term political rivals in the ANC. Cyril Ramaphosa not only replaced him after being his deputy president, but in January of this year kicked him out of the party completely for setting up the Mkhonto Wesizwe party. And also, Zuma believes that Cyril Ramaphosa is responsible for leaking the classified documents about him to the media that contributed to the legacy he's obtained, and also criminal charges levelled against him. So Jacob Zuma, I don't think, is coming into this because he wants to have a grand return to the top of South African politics. I think a lot of it is motivated by spite towards Cyril Ramaphosa at the top of South African politics.
It's so funny you just said that. Like, literally, like, look what you make me do is a good analogy, if I use a Taylor Swift analogy, to describe Jacob Zuma's relationship, and I say, and his eventual political comeback, and how he might be feeling on election night. But I think you're absolutely right that it is motivated by, in many ways, a vindictive reason for why he wants to come back to South African politics, because he actually gets quite a lot of benefits from being an ex-president, which, if he were to get back into the South African parliament, he will lose. So he also has something at stake here. But despite Cyril Ramaphosa serving in Jacob Zuma's cabinet as deputy president, the relationship between these two men is non-existent. And I think Jacob Zuma himself knows that in his home province of KwaZulu-Natal, he still has political support. And I think I'll be looking on election night in South Africa to how the MK party, and I should say as well that his new party, the MK party, or in English, the translation is Spear the Nation, It's actually a homage to the ANC military wing in the past as well. So he chose that name quite deliberately, I would say. And I'll be looking to see what only, not only is the votes in KwaZulu-Natal, because this is a key province for the ANC itself. In the last three elections, the ANC's vote in this province was the reason why the party was able to get over 50% of the national vote. And now you have a figure, a key influential figure who can pull votes in KwaZulu-Natal moving out of the ANC. I think that really impacts the ANC's ability to get 50% purely because of how influential this province is to getting the 50% it needs as well. I should be interesting to note as well. One more point is that Jacob Zuma has charisma and that populist appeal that I think Cyril Ramaphosa, who is a much more managerial style, a technocrat, doesn't. So that's why he probably retains his appeal. And therefore, I'm curious to see what happens, because not only is there elections to the National Assembly, the 400-seat National Assembly you talked about, but there are also elections to the provincial legislatures as well, all throughout South Africa. I will be very interested to see what the political breakdown in KwaZulu-Natal is after this election. They already lost the Western Cape. I think Gauteng and KwaZulu-Natal, these are the two provinces that I will be key to watch at a state level what has happened in these elections. And whether Jacob Zuma could inflict further damage to at the state-provincial level as well, isn't it?
I mean, Mkhonto Waziswe currently polling around 13%, which obviously is not anywhere close to being the largest party. But given that that 13% is quite heavily concentrated in two provinces in South Africa, and because of how this electoral system worked, this could have quite a dent on the ANC's support and is picking up areas that traditionally have been quite bastions of ANC support, as you said, Chern. So that's why they're having such an impact on this. But the irony of all of this is that after this election takes place, should the ANC require some support to get into majority, the Mkhonto Waziswe party is one of those parties that they might be turning to ask for that support. So yes, Jacob Zuma could be standing in the way of Cyril Ramaphosa, but there may come a point where they might have to work together to try and form a government, and that's going to be the most interesting part of this. Obviously, there is another big player in this election. One, the economic freedom fighters, the more Marxist, anti-land confiscation, left-wing, former wing of the ANC. But then you have the main opposition party, which is the Democratic Alliance. So, Chern, a few words on them. One, why are they not capitalising on the ANC support falling more widely? And two, is there a role for them in this post-election world?
Well, I should just say that the Economic Freedom Fighters, founded by Julius Malimba, who was a former youth leader of the ANC. So the irony is that the ANC will have to turn to someone, either the former president expelled or the former youth leader expelled, to try and form a coalition government, which is a prospect the ANC, I think, is not looking particularly forward to. But you're right, the Democratic Alliance has been rather consistent in opinion polls. They've polled between 20 and 25% throughout, I would say, the last couple of elections. The problem the Democratic Alliance face is that primarily is still seen as the party of the white minority. And I think that's a problem, really, for the Democratic Alliance, is that unless it makes further inroads into the majority black population, they're simply not going to be able to get anywhere close to government itself. It could be the party did elect a black leader between 2015, but it was soon after the 2019 election when the party lost five seats. So I would say that the problem they have is more structural, and unless South African politics moves fundamentally beyond the race cleavage, they just naturally have a ceiling of support that unfortunately, it's not going to get them anywhere in a proportional representation system.
And I mean, the Democratic Alliance actually emerged as an anti-apartheid movement during the apartheid era. So that is the interesting facet of this, is they're now seen as the white minority party, but actually they spent all of their political history campaigning against that establishment in South Africa. So that's an interesting part of this. But you're absolutely right, Chern. I think they do face some structural problems. And I think ideological positioning is also a bit of an issue because they're much more pro-privatisation, mixed economy. They've argued against the ANC's black economic empowerment policy because they claim that it's led to the concentration of wealth in a few black elites rather than widespreading that wealth across the black population in South Africa. I think there is an inroad here because obviously, given the failure of some of the state-run institutions in South Africa, I think there is a place to be arguing about some more privatization in the country as an option to solve that problem. But yeah, I think that is the structural problems are quite difficult for the DA to overcome, even though the Western Cape, which they currently run on a provincial level, is pretty widely regarded as one of the best governed provinces in South Africa. It has some of the best outcomes, and it's becoming such a problem that the Democratic Alliance actually seems to be conducting their own foreign policy from within the Western Cape, because a Democratic Alliance delegation went to the US to convince the Congress to maintain trade within the AGOA, the African Growth and Opportunity Act, in reaction to the South African proximity to Russia and China, and also in the aftermath of the ICG case they were launching against Israel. So the DA are getting their foreign policy chops sharpened, but they look a far cry from being in the federal government.
I will say though, I was just looking at Kwasi Nutu Zatel because of the impact of Jacob Zuma there as well. But the DA candidate in that province is really interesting. Have you heard of him? So his name is Chris Pappas. He is 32 years old, a white mayor, basically municipal mayor running. And he speaks fluent Zulu, which is the national language of... So it'll be interesting to see whether he's able to... And he's also one of Africa's only openly gay mayors. So an interesting candidate that they have put forward in KwaZulu-Natal. I will be looking at it because I'm curious about how the MK party is done. But I also think that it also shows that the Democratic Alliance is a more liberal party, not necessarily that conservative white party as it was in apartheid. So it's ironic that they have this reputation, but I just thought that was an interesting candidate they have nominated as well. And of course, at a provincial level, I'll be looking at Gauteng, because that was the big hope in 2019. In 2019, their leader back then, the reason why they had chosen its first black leader was because they wanted to make inroads in Gauteng, because he ran in 2014 in the provincial campaign and failed in 2019. Mm. So,
and who knows, given the split in the votes on the traditional ANC wing of Gauteng voters, the DA could be poised to sneak first, if not first place, very close.
Well, I think that's the key thing, isn't it, Sam? Is that the irony is that the ANC is losing support, but it's not losing support to the DA. It's spraying across all, both to a larger extent, to the MK led by Jacob Zuma and the EFF, the Economic Freedom Fighters. They're not going to the DA. So they might win first place purely because they are holding that vote and maybe gaining a few extra support. But the reality is that they'll find it difficult to form government in Gauteng and Kwasi Nutu Zatel unless they increase the support among black voters. Would you not agree?
Oh, absolutely. And Chern, in the build-up to this election, the opposition have been trying to combine to try and oust the ANC. They've signed the multi-party charter, which is not an in advance of the election agreement, but it's saying if we're in a position to be able to form a government, we will do, and we won't try and steal each other's votes. But it's becoming a bit fractious because since then, John Steenhuisen has actually been accusing some of the smaller parties of disproportionately targeting voters in the Western Cape, which the DA already control, rather than going after some ANC-controlled provinces around the country. So it's not particularly happy families on the opposition side either. But what I do find, taking a sort of helicopter view further out of this election, what's really fascinating about this election is that for the first time since 1994, the election feels, for lots of parties, genuinely competitive. And I think that's nothing but a good thing for democracies around the world, is that you're now seeing opposition parties starting to fight for each other's votes. You're seeing more parties on the ANC wing of South African politics competing for each other's votes. And the DA behaving like a party who at some point in South Africa's democratic future may be competitive to hold federal government. And I think that's really interesting, because until now, it's very much seen like, well, what percentage are the ANC going to get to over 50? Whereas now it's very much like the ANC are going to have to work with someone. Who will that be? Could they countenance working with the Democratic Alliance? And then on the provincial level, the DA now control the Western Cape. Are they going to be competitive in Gauteng? Could they be competitive in other provinces? And that's telling quite an interesting story in South African politics. That's a very different story from the last 30 years.
I think you're right. It'd be interesting to see what happens in turnout, because turnout has been fell 10% over the last two elections. Largely, I suspect, is discontented voters within the black voters who decided not to vote. Now I wonder, particularly, there's more competition among for that black vote, what they might decide to do turnout. And on that note, Sam, I think it's not going to be a challenge to find out who's going to win this election, because I think the ANC will win this election. But I think the question or the prediction we should make, and I'm glad I'm asking this because I'm genuinely keen for your thoughts, is how do you think Jacob Zuma's party will do? And how do you think the DA will do?
I think Jacob Zuma's MK party will probably do around what the opinion polls are projecting now, because I think there is a natural ceiling on that level of support. So I'm looking at like early teens, 10%, UKIP 2015 levels of support. And because of the way South Africa's electoral system works, that'll translate roughly into that percentage of seats as well. And then the DA, I think, will be sort of mid to high 20s and will, I think, will have one of their highest seat counts that they've had in South African general elections. And ultimately, the ANC will perform around the high 30s, 40%, and then will be able to form a pretty stable majority if they work with economic freedom fighters. So that's where I think this election will fall out. But I think it will set the scene moving forwards, as I said, for a much more competitive landscape in South African electoral politics.
Interesting you say that, because I think, I'm not sure whether they will cooperate with the EFF. I think it depends how many seats they fall short of the winning margin. They might turn to a smaller party first if they only are a couple of seat shots, rather than turn to the EFF or Jacob Zuma's party. So I think that that discussion on who their coalition partners in the event they fall short will have to wait till after the election. I largely agree with your vote share breakdown as well. I think in the last election, there was a 5-point slippage in the Western Cape support for the DA. So I think some people are wondering whether in the Western Cape, there could be a further erosion of DA support. And that's why some of these small opposition parties are looking at the Western Cape with interest, and the DA has had to fend them off and say, hey, look somewhere else, which is what I think the original purpose of that coalition was. So I think that's just one point to make in general. I will be interested to look at what happens at the provincial government level, because particularly in KwaZulu-Natal, because that is Jacob Zuma's homeland province. I think Gauteng, there's enough. The ANC got over 50% of the vote. They probably will do a bit like what will happen nationally, which is fall below that. But there'll be enough of the other parties to support the ANC retaining the premiership. But I genuinely think that X factor of how this new candidate from the DA will perform in him winning a municipality in KwaZulu-Natal in the first place, and then also his unique profile alongside Jacob Zuma's outsized political influence in his homeland province. I'd be really interested to see that state breakdown, because I genuinely can't predict who will be the new premier of KwaZulu-Natal after this election. So I'll be looking to that with keen interest.
Well, Chen, there's just over a month to go until the South African general election. A lot has changed in the last month in South Africa. So It'll be a very fascinating campaign, and I look forward to unpacking it after that election has taken place. But for now, that is it for the latest episode of Ballot to Talk About. Do join us again next time when we'll be previewing the mammoth general election that is already taking place in India and will continue for the next 6 to 8 weeks. But as always, we'll continue to keep you up to date on the world of politics and elections from around the world. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at @ballot_talk. Please leave us a rating or review, or you can also email any feedback or comments to ballottotalkabout@gmail.com. My name is Sam, and until next time, we'll speak to you soon.